It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. What a day yesterday was. Hurricane Ida, what was left of it, made its way through here. Heavy, heavy downpour. In fact, the kids were talking about going and filling up the inflatable rafts and going down the street with the huge amount of water that was flowing like a river down the hill. And, you know, it was so bad that this is the weirdest thing. The school district actually canceled school yesterday in advance out of fear of rain, and a two-hour delay today out of fear of flooding. And look, the creek where we live by, really high. And it's one of those things where, you know, I'm grateful to live in an elevated spot, you know, on the good land. I feel sorry for the people who were down where it was flooded and in all of the places that were flooded. And it got me thinking today, because we were in New Orleans about a year and a half after Katrina. Things were still a mess, but they had gotten some things back together. And it's when the convention centers were starting to do conferences and stuff again. We were at the beginning of that. And I went down with a reporting group, and they had their conference there. And, you know, we got to go and do a whole bunch of stories about, you know, the cleanup and the recovery. And my focus was on what the unions were doing in New Orleans to help rebuild, and the union members on how they were affected. And, you know, it's just one of those things that I look at it and I go, you know, the lesson should have been learned right there. And you go, but Rick, that's, you know, once in a 100-year thing. And who knew that the levees were going to breach, and who knew that this was going to happen? Well, evidently they did, because, you know, they had a decade earlier predicted that eventually those levees would break and you would end up with New Orleans in this giant soup bowl of nasty. And what it was, and it's what stuck with me, and it was a conversation I had today that reminded me of the, you know, some of the people that we met when we were down in New Orleans after the hurricane. And, you know, there was one guy that sticks out in particular, because he was one of the people who was, you know, going around rescuing people off of rooftops. He was someone who was jumping in the water all the time, you know, pulling boats along behind him to bring, you know, rescue supplies to help bring people to better spots. And he said, look, you know, we were in the poor parish. You know, we were in I think it was Jefferson Parish is where, you know, a lot of the ugliness happened. This is where we were. And right there are these huge oil refineries, these big chemical companies, you know, all of this toxic stew. And he was telling the story of you know, those days, those weeks where, you know, you were on your own. And he said, you know, the water was, he did this, one of these things, there, the water was up to my chest. And he put it, pointed his hand to his chest. And you go, you know, he goes, I'll never forget it. I'll never forget the water was this high. And I said, well, you know, he was just being, you know, are you sure it was that high and it wasn't, you know, lower or higher? He took off his shirt and there was a line where he was basically burned from that line all the way down his body. Looked like he was scarred for the entire bottom, you know, 80% of his body, because of the chemicals and the stuff that was in the water, this toxic stew that just stayed there, because they didn't have the ability to pump it out. And, you know, I remember back then going, I hope we learned the lesson. And now, fortunately, you know, the levees held. Fortunately, they didn't have it. We haven't had another Katrina-type event. But understand, our storms are getting worse. Our infrastructure is getting older, more outdated. And, you know, I was watching a clip on Fox News, And there was a moment where the guy who was the host, said, we're going to pull away from this press conference that they were having on the hurricane because it's getting political, he said. They're making this political with their so-called climate change. And I'm going, dude, the once every 100-year heat wave is now once every decade. The 100-year storm and flood is now happening every 10, 15 years. And it's going to get worse. These storms are going to get much worse, much bigger, much, much more aggressive. Have you seen the videos coming out of New York City of the subways that are literally, it looks like Niagara Falls in the subways as water is just pouring down the subways? Because we don't have the infrastructure to deal with that kind of a situation. But we better figure it out. We better start investing in how to make sure that our citizens are cared for and our infrastructure doesn't continue to fail us. In Mississippi, they had that, what was it, like a 60-foot round giant sinkhole open up and swallow, what was it, 7, 8 cars, 10 cars and a motorcycle, I think it was. A couple people got killed. I've been saying for a while, maybe we need to go, since everybody's on their phone all the time, somebody needs to develop an app. To say, hey, you're on a road that was, built in, during the Great Depression. The WPA built this road. The CCC built this road. This bridge is, 20 years outdated. Call home. Say goodbye to mom. You might not make it down the road. And we've got people who are going, well, we really need to not spend all that money on, infrastructure and stuff. It's crazy. Absolutely crazy. And it just kind of blew my mind to hear this Fox guy go, well, we're going to pull away from this because they're getting political, talking about that climate change. And you go, how at this point can you deny it? How is it possible at this moment in history you can deny it? And look, the weather's going to get more extreme. We know that as the planet gets warmer. I'm no meteorologist. But I've talked to a few. It is a recipe for disaster. And here we are. And all we get, and this is the thing that bothers me, all we get from the Fox News is and the right-wing propaganda machine is, oh, it's all a hoax. It doesn't exist. It's not real. They're just making it political. Democrats better get their behinds moving because there's a lot of misinformation. The right-wing disinformation machine is working overtime. I mean, you look at what they've done with Afghanistan. First it was, they hate dogs. They left the dogs behind. Not one U.S. military dog was left behind. Not one. They left $83 billion of weapons and piles of cash for the Taliban to grab up. Trump and all his buddies and, the dumb Trumps. All those social media accounts, they're all lying. And there's no accountability for it. Because we didn't leave $83 billion worth of weapons behind. But again, the big lie. Lots of the big lie. We lost the war. Joe Biden lost the war because he pulled out. The old George Carlin joke. I say we keep it in there and get the job done. Dumbest thing ever. But here's the thing. The right-wing misinformation machine, their tactic is to continue to keep people enraged, hyper-raged, 24/7, 365, hyper-raged, foaming at the mouth, rabid, because it's what they do. So that the big lie, and the bigger the lie is, the more they believe. They left $83 billion worth of weapons. You go, do you know how much $83 billion is? And what the cameras pan to when they show what we left behind were a bunch of broken down things that we destroyed before we left. Because we didn't have room on the planes to get them out. Because, hey, we had to get people out. We had to get the U.S. service dogs out. Are you going to take the Black Hawk helicopter Are you going to take the tank? You're going to take all that stuff and shove it? No, you're going women and children first. Get the dogs and the soldiers out. Get the people out. Get them out. And they did an incredible job. But the right-wing lie machine, and again, the bigger the lie, the more their minions eat it up. The more outrage candy they get. We end up with a broken political system where you end up with a Texas who is now, thank you, Susan Collins, because evidently Susan Collins is disappointed. Susan Collins, who voted for all of the Supreme Court justices who have said, no, we don't care about women and their rights. She's now disappointed. Disappointed. Just disappointed. As she was disappointed about a couple of other things in the past where she's been wrong. And you know what's disappointing to me? That Maine didn't throw her out on her ear. Maine, you had the chance. So today, Joe Biden came out on the Supreme Court, said the Supreme Court's ruling overnight is an unprecedented assault on a woman's constitutional rights under Roe versus Wade. Which has been the law of the land for almost 50 years. Yes, they have overturned what has been almost 50 years of decided law, just like they did when the Janus decision overturned 40 years of labor law, making the entire country a no-rights-at-work country. Congratulations. And this is where Democrats, you better wake up, because all the stuff you ran on in 2020... protecting the right to vote, protecting a woman's right to choose, rebuilding the economy by strengthening unions and getting people's jobs, taking care of the virus, which you're doing the best you can on, and protecting workers' rights. You can't rerun on those in 2020. You have to accomplish them now. And this it starts with this most recent court decision. That has seriously set women back 100 years. Jerry Nadler, Judiciary Committee Chairman, said because the court has now shown regressive state legislatures how to game the system, the House Judiciary Committee will hold hearings to shine a light on the Supreme Court's dangerous and cowardly use of a shadow docket. Look, we knew that's what's going to happen all along. It's what they've done. There's no surprise here. Jen Psaki, press secretary, asked a male reporter, said, "I know you've never faced those choices, nor have you ever been pregnant. But for women out there who have faced those choices, this is an incredibly difficult thing. The president believes that right should be respected." But these guys don't. I mean, that's the weird part of all this. And I saw a video today of this crazy right-wing group that's basically a hotline for you to turn in your neighbor, for you to spy on your neighbor. And good on the people, seriously, good on the people of Texas and around the country for spamming the heck out of that number, basically shutting their site down and reporting everybody and anybody, because this is a joke. It's an absolute joke that a state is saying, hey, citizens, if you spy on each other and you bring us credible information and we put a woman in jail for having an abortion and all the people who helped her, the cab driver who took her, the mother who gave her money, the boyfriend who, you know, picked her up, the doctor who did it, the nurse who signed her in, if you turn them all in and give us all the details, all the gory seated details, so they can be alone at night by themselves with a box of Kleenex, we'll give you $10,000. We'll give you 10 grand. So we can turn citizens against one another. And look, everyone's going, well, where'd that come from? Why'd they do that? Huh? Who decided that? I know who did it. This was the boyfriend, the husband, the father. This was the person who's going to punish that woman for how dare she. This was about punishment. And this is about making sure that everybody looks down on this person and sees them as a profit motive. Now they say, oh, we're going to respect their privacy rights. What privacy rights are you talking about? How do you do that? Also weird. I happened to be looking up stories today, and I found a couple years ago that the state of Missouri, evidently checking on Planned Parenthood, was actually following women's cycles. You got the state looking at over women's shoulder. Evidently, these apps that you get, I didn't even know there were, but there are apps where you can follow whatever the monthly cycle thing is. They're following that. This is the kind of stuff that somebody's going to be tracking. They hack into your cell phone. They know this information. And, oh, if it doesn't come, we're turning you in. And the lawyers have got to be just thrilled. The amount of court cases this could for defending and prosecuting. Wow. Lawyer's wet dream. Now you got Kamala Harris saying that the decision is not the last word on Roe versus Wade. We'll not stand by and allow our nation to go back to the days of backroom abortions. We'll use every lever of our administration to defend the right to a safe and legal abortion, blah, 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 blah. Nancy Pelosi blahs on too. We're going to codify it into law. Merrick Garland said the Justice Department's deeply concerned. Do something about it. Don't talk about it. Do it. And pull Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema in and say, look, we'll sacrifice you. At some point, you've got to save your soul. At some point, you've got to stand and fight. Justice Sonia Sotomayor, in her dissent, said a majority of justices have opted to bury their heads in the sand. I wholeheartedly disagree with the Supreme Court justice on this. This is why they were put there. We've known it all along. And for everyone who said, no, don't worry about it. They're just corporatists. And look, I'm one of them who said they are corporatists. But they were put there for this too. Because the corporatists want, well, they want desperation class workers. And what better way to keep people desperate? Pump them full of kids. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. And workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win. On the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1910. That was the day the Protocol of Peace brought an end to the cloakmaker strike in New York City. The garment industry had been rocked by the uprising of 20,000 months earlier. Young women had struck hundreds of small shops over pay, recognition, and working conditions. They won ILGWU recognition in all but a handful of shops. 60,000 cloakmakers in the city were inspired to walk out of the sweatshops that July. The mostly male strike force demanded shorter hours and increased pay, the closed shop, and more. Union membership soared, and most of the small shops caved. The larger manufacturers would not, however, and by the end of the summer, the Protocol of Peace was negotiated. Future Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis figured prominently in the negotiations. The protocol established higher wages, shorter hours, and overtime pay. It also guaranteed the union shop, elimination of contracting, and monitoring of piecework rates. Even more significant, workers won a union health center, a board of sanitary control, a board of grievances, and a board of arbitration. For the first time, garment workers had access to health care, a way to eliminate sweatshop conditions, and a way to mediate and resolve shop floor complaints. The price to be paid, however, was that workers would give up their most powerful leveraging tool, the right to strike. The agreement was lauded as a step forward for industrial democracy. But soon, many workers complained that the protocol failed to answer a number of shop floor issues. Grievances piled up, and workers were penalized when they attempted to strike to resolve their problems. The protocol would be scrapped for a return to militant strikes during the 1920s. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I said earlier, these storms, they're going to get worse. And we need the investment now while we have the opportunity. We need to rebuild this country and to attempt to adapt to the storms that are coming, the kind of heavy rains we're going to get. I mean, look at New York City, crippled because its subway system is drowning. The roads, just underwater. I'm told this stuff is going to happen again and again, and it's going to happen more frequently. So we've got to make these investments now, which is why I'm a big fan of investing heavily in infrastructure. We could have done more with the bipartisan bill, but the Build Back Better plan, something we need to do. And here to share some thoughts on how we do some of that, I've asked Representative Andy Levin to come talk with us. Andy is on the House Education and Foreign Relations Committee. He's a representative for Michigan's 9th Congressional District. Andy, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it's great to be with you.
I appreciate you taking time for us. So have you seen these videos coming out of New York where it basically looks like Niagara Falls at every stop along the subway line?
I haven't seen them yet, but look, Rick, it just shows you the interconnection between infrastructure and climate change. You know, we have got to fix our roads and bridges and so forth, but we've got to get serious about climate change. The Build Back Better budget would be, if we can pass it as we're planning, it'll be by far the biggest intervention on climate change, in addition to doing a lot of important infrastructure and human infrastructure work too.
No, most certainly something we need. But, you know, I always point to the American Society of Civil Engineers, who say right now, today, as of this moment, Representative, we need $4.6 trillion. That's not what's being proposed for just our hard infrastructure, let alone our needs in everything else. So while I'm going, you know, this is historic investment, you know, the smart people, the people with the pencils and the slide rules, they're saying it's not near enough.
No, that's right. And I mean, they're talking about everything it would take to fix, you know, to get everything up to where it should be. So you don't have to do all that spending at once.
Right.
But I think we should be spending much more on this infrastructure. Rick, it's a great investment. And it's, you know, all that phony talk of supply side economics for all those years. Oh, just give rich people a tax cut and, you know, everybody will come out good. Well, that didn't happen. On the other hand, if you actually improve your infrastructure, make sure all poor kids, rural and urban, have broadband, right? Build out the infrastructure so that people can charge electric vehicles. They can buy the dang things because they could drive them wherever they want without running out of juice. Those kind of real investments really do help us in the long run because they make us more competitive. They create more jobs.
No, and look, the one of the big things that I point to, and look, I love the plan. I love the direction. I love the Buy American provision in here that says, hey, if we're going to rebuild these roads and bridges, we're going to use American steel and concrete. And we're going to use American workers. And for me, the fact that the Republicans weren't able to strip out prevailing wage laws out of it, this means that the workers doing those jobs are going to have good, solid, family-sustaining wage jobs, which is going to help everybody.
No question. I mean, we're now writing right into our bills the most aggressive pro-worker and pro-union language that you've ever seen. I mean, so for example, in my EV Freedom Act, which can't be in there exactly because it's a reconciliation package, so it can't have so much policy. But in the bill as I wrote it, there's neutrality in there, dude. If workers want to form a union, the boss is to get out of the way and let them decide on their own, right? We've got IBEW training standards, essentially, for electricians if they're going to, work on adding this kind of new vehicle electrification infrastructure.
As we should. I mean, they're the smart people. They're the ones who know how to do this stuff. We should let them do it.
Right. And, you know, as well as prevailing wage and all the health and safety provisions. So it's really important to make sure that we basically make everything we can in America and have it all made by well-paid union represented workers.
No, I'm right there with you. But here's a problem. You got Joe Manchin in West Virginia, who just came out today, said we need to take a pause on that big plan. Evidently too much in there he's not happy with. So how do we get that moved through? Because, look, everybody I talk to, when you start talking about nuts and bolts, getting kids college education, helping grandma get a new set of chompers and maybe a hearing aid, doing the human infrastructure stuff that does, like long-term care for people, all the stuff that we've needed for decades, everyone's for it. How do we get Joe Manchin and the rest of the party on board?
Well, you're right. I mean, of course, the problem is that we have the narrowest possible majority in the Senate. We need every single Democrat to vote for this, because let's remember, not one Republican will, not one. And it's almost the same in the House, though, Rick. I mean, right. You know, our majority is like 3 or 4, depending on the moment. So we are going to have to pass something that can get every single vote. And I don't know why some of these really conservative Democrats don't want to do super popular stuff that creates great jobs and makes America more competitive. But we're going to have to convince them, bring them along, package this up in a way that can get everybody's votes. We don't have a way around it.
Yeah, especially someone like Manchin, who, you know, a massive investment into West Virginia could turn that state somewhere in a positive direction. But here's the thing, and this is where I think the conventional wisdom is. If the Republicans can roadblock and stall and delay long enough, if we don't get something on infrastructure, if we don't get something on voting rights, it's going to be a long year in 2022 for Democrats. And I hear, you know, the former guy is about to announce he's going to run in 2024 here in a couple of days. So how do you do that?
Well, I think that, first of all, we have to realize that we did something massive with the American Rescue Plan, and we can't let that get lost in the shuffle. I mean, imagine every poor family, every working class family, middle class, way up into the upper middle class, every family is getting $250 a month or $300 a month for every kid. $250 if they're 6 or over, $300 a month if they're under 6. My wife and I remember the days when our oldest is 28 now, man. But I remember when we had 3 kids, 5 and under in the house, that would be $900 a month. I mean, that's transformative for working class or middle class families. And so we've got to keep that going. We improved, let's not forget, the Affordable Care Act significantly, made it way easier and more affordable for people to get coverage. We've got to keep that going. So I'm hopeful we can pass this full infrastructure and, human infrastructure bill to create jobs, cut taxes, and lower costs for people. And we're just going to have to duke it out internally to make sure we get everybody on board. I mean, whatever it takes.
Ultimately, as I've been saying for a while, we need to figure out how we pay for this stuff. And you do that by taxing the people who have been getting away with not paying taxes for decades. I'm sorry, we have a billionaire class that since the beginning of the pandemic until now saw their wealth go up 62%. Our billionaire class saw an extra $1.8 trillion lining their pockets while people are afraid that they're going to get evicted from their homes. It's time to start going passing the hat in that crowd. At least that's my view.
I mean, what if we just said, hey, you all were super billionaires before. Why don't we just start with that $1.6 trillion as a pay for? You know, but in all seriousness, we absolutely need to tax people. Billionaires should not be paying virtually no taxes, as we saw was revealed recently for you know, person after person paying no or virtually no taxes. Just outrageous. Secondly, corporations have to pay their share. And I really like what Janet Yellen is doing about trying to make sure, get a global compact to make sure all corporations globally pay at least 15% in taxes. But we've got to beef up the IRS to collect the taxes that people owe.
Yeah, great.
You and I pay our taxes, but if there's not enforcement from the IRS, some of these super rich people, get away with not even paying the taxes that they definitely do owe. So all that needs to happen.
Yeah, we got a lot of work ahead of us.
We can pay for a lot of this. with that. I got a cool way to pay for a little tiny bit of it.
Hit me.
We got to include the penalties from the PRO Act in here, which we plan to do, which will raise some revenue. So it works as for this, like reconciliation, because whatever you put in there has to either, you know, raise revenue or raise the deficit. And we have no meaningful penalties against employers when they violate workers' rights for trying to form a union, for, you know, demonstrating for a good contract, whatever. So if we include these penalties in there, that'll raise a little bit of revenue, but it'll also make it easier for workers to form unions. And that's a benefit in and of itself. So there's some things in there that are really important that will raise a little bit of revenue. And then I think we can raise a lot of revenue by increasing taxes on big corporations and the wealthiest.
No, I'm right there with you. But, you know, to your point on the fines for people who violate the labor laws, I've been saying for years, our labor laws are broken. The pendulum has swung way too far to the side of corporations, and we need something. And if it's just a little bit of, you know, a couple of fines, that's a help. But I still think we need major comprehensive overhaul to our labor law. Because, you know, employers have figured out how to get around them. All this misclassification, all of this independent contractor nonsense. We're now seeing Uber and Lyft spending another couple hundred million dollars in Massachusetts to do what they did in California. The moneyed interests, I don't know that a couple of fines are really going to hurt the big boys, because Amazon spent $200 million to keep workers from organizing in Alabama. In freaking Alabama.
Dude, I was there. You know, you're totally right. The PRO Act is my number one priority in Congress. And it's funny you should mention it, because I was just out in an event in Macomb County, and the national leader of the Young Dems Labor Caucus is one of my constituents, Rob Szymborski. And he was there showing me pictures about all their activism about on the two senators from Arizona and the one from Virginia, who are, you know, say they won't co-sponsor. Now I heard that Senator Warner says he's on board or something. Anyway, people need to hit the street. They need to get creative. We all need to tell stories. Like, think about this Nabisco strike that's going on right now. What a great, everybody knows about Oreos and whatever else they make, right? Well, you know, one of the things the PRO Act does that was barred since 1947, it's Taft-Hartley amendments, is let workers just act in solidarity with workers from another company. Yep. I mean, that's basic, the most basic freedom of expression should be a First Amendment right, right? So the Nabisco strike is a great example, right? Because everybody knows about Oreos and all those products that they have. So it would be huge if we passed the PRO Act when, you know, truckers or other workers from another company could say, no, I'm not crossing that picket line. And my job's not going to be at stake either, because I have a right to act in solidarity with workers in another company, because there's such a thing as working people sticking together. I mean, that's what has been lost in this country. And that's why the PRO Act is so important.
Yeah, it's one of those things that absolutely I'm in favor of. And, you know, I, in talking about the Nabisco strike, I love the fact that the train operator refused to deliver the flour because he was not going to, under any circumstances, cross a picket line. We got to go back to that. I mean, at the end of the day, I think we have to go back to, it still comes down to you and me and the working class people in this country saying, you know, we've had enough and we're going to act in solidarity with one another.
100%. And, you know, you're seeing it really hopeful signs all around if the politicians could just catch up to the people. I mean, look at all the workers in like the tech industry and the like digital media and stuff forming unions. You can't even keep up with all of it, really. Yeah. There are many groups that are forming unions, and we just need like working class service workers to be able to form a union without getting their chops busted. But that, you know, the way the labor law is now, if you're a restaurant chain or a hotel chain or, you know, any big company, Walmart, of course, example number one, right? You can prevent your workers from forming union through legal and illegal means, and there's basically no consequence to it.
And this is why I like that you're talking about fines.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is that they're not a cure-all. But if you put big, these are serious fines, you know, multiple damages, possibilities for punitive damages, and escalating fines for repeat offenses and stuff. So I think it really would affect company behavior on organizing campaigns. Maybe not an Amazon, but, you know, a lot of companies, I think it would.
Yeah, I would love to see that go into a nationwide strike fund, like an unemployment benefit for people who are on strike or locked out. That would be something interesting. So I guess last line of questioning, how do we get people motivated to contact their representatives and push this? Because ultimately it's going to come down to a vote, which now, as I said, Joe Manchin said he wants to put a pause on, which is a struggle for me because I don't think we get anything then.
Well, we don't. I mean, I hate that Joe Manchin suddenly has all this power. People, you know, say he does, but it is true that every single Democratic senator has to vote for whatever emerges. And we have very little time. So I'd encourage people to act right now. Here's the thing. If you want dental and vision and hearing, like hearing aids, to be covered in Medicare, get on your dang phone and call your senator or representative. Write a letter, send an email. If you want childcare for, you know, available and pre-K for 3 and 4 year olds so that kids can get a great start and parents can go to work, get on your dang phone. If you want free community college, this is my America's College Promise Act. It's in this bill. So, you know, if we end up having to cut the money, Rick, I figure we'll just not be able to do as much of these things. But this is the most transformative piece of legislation in decades. Because it covers so many things, it's probably the biggest thing, even bigger than anything in the war on poverty, because it covers a lot of things. Imagine if child care and pre-K workers were treated like teachers and were able to have unions and were made a middle-class wage, you know. So this is, yep, this would be huge for the working people of this country.
No, it's kind of like a reset button to undo some of the damage over the last 40 years of supply side voodoo Reaganomics and moving us back to where we had a social compact and we were kind of helping each other out, making college more affordable, college more affordable, healthcare more accessible, and an infrastructure that actually, benefits us. We got a lot to do, and I hope folks will reach out and contact you and others to make sure it gets done. But Representative Levin, I appreciate the time. As always, great talking with you, and please keep up the fight for labor.
You got it, Rick. Good to see you again. Take care of yourself.
You as well. Thanks so much, our good friend, Representative Andy Levin. Make sure you check out his website, andylevin.house.gov. We'll get links out on social media, how you can take a look at that. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1974. That was the day that President Gerald Ford signed the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. The act was passed over growing concern about the mismanagement of private pension plans in the country. In 1963, the Studebaker Corporation closed its auto plant. Its pension plan was a mess. Nearly 7,000 workers received only 15% of their pension or nothing at all. Across the country, more and more workers were relying on private pensions. In 1960, 21.2 million workers had private pensions. By 1970, the number stood at 30 million. The funds in those pension plans had nearly tripled in that same decade to $138 billion. workers. Ensuring the security of those pensions was essential for millions of workers and the stability of the economy. At the bill signing, President Ford explained, quote, "Dramatic growth in recent years has thrust private pension plans into a central role in determining how older Americans live in their retirement years. Yet, this same growth in pension plans has brought with it a host of new problems. Many workers have ultimately lost their benefits, even after relatively long service, because when they left jobs, they thereby gave up rights to hard-earned pension benefits. Others have sustained hardships because their companies folded with insufficient funds in the pension plan to pay promised pensions. In addition, some pension funds have been invested primarily for the benefit of the companies or plan administrators, not for the workers. It is essential to bring some order and humanity to this welter of different and sometimes inequitable retirement plans within private industry." President Ford signed the bill on Labor Day and outlined minimum standards for private pensions.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I've been saying, I'm thrilled by the fact that we are out of Afghanistan, finally 20 years, what my friend Rich calls the forever war. And it's about time. And look, I give Joe Biden credit, had the courage to get us out. All the right-wing mouthpieces and all of the Twitter bots attacking him. Look, Herculean leap getting out of there as quickly as we did and as efficiently. An incredible thing. Now, I've been saying, look, if you're outraged or that there may have been a dog left behind or someone decided they wanted to stay or they didn't get the right flight or whatever, take that anger and bring it back home and let's figure out how we take care of the people who for the last 20 years have been involved in this forever war. And here to share some thoughts on maybe how we can begin to do that, I've asked my good friend Pat LaMarche to come talk with us. Pat is an author, in fact, the author of our book, Daddy, What's the Middle Class? Also, she is a homelessness awareness activist. She's got a new comic book out. The launch, I guess, coming up sometime really soon. The comic book, Invisible. It is about our veterans and a superhero experiencing homelessness. Pat, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, Rick, you know, I would drop everything for you.
I appreciate that. And you have a lot of time, so thank you. This new comic book, you know, a comic book about homelessness. I mean, my first thought was, how does that work? Walk me through what Invisible is.
Okay, so first of all, every single human being experiencing homelessness is a superhero or they wouldn't survive it. But it's a comic book drawn by Jason So, who's a really remarkable, pretty famous comic book artist who hails from this area originally, and he is the architect of the Necroman series. So if you're into zombies, you know exactly who Jason So is. And he approached me and said, you know, I want to make a comic book where with a superhero that's homeless. And I said, he asked me if I'd write it, and I'd never written a comic book, although I've read plenty. And I said, you know, I will do it as long as I can make him a veteran. Because having run homeless shelters myself, I was vice president of Safe Harbor in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, as well as the operations manager of a place called Community Cares. The people I saw experiencing homelessness turned to the veteran of the group every time there was a crisis. They're the only people who are uniquely trained to experience hardship. Like when a mom with two kids gets evicted, which is get ready for it because it's been bad before, but it's about to get worse with that moratorium lifted.
Right.
The guy who is sitting next to her, he's not intimidated by the terrible or the gal. Lots of really great female veterans also. There was a wonderful woman that was in my shelter who had been a desalination specialist in Iraq and came home, of course, injured, didn't have any real money to rely on, and had two daughters. What happens to you? You end up homeless. So, and I'm thinking, boy, clean water, isn't that a job we could really put somebody to work in the United States with?
Yeah,
right?
Really.
You know? But anyway, so I've watched these people for years and years, decades, and how they handle adversity, and the veterans are just the best prepared to do it. Ironically, the Veterans Administration also does the best job of getting people out of homelessness. So these superheroes on the street are plucked out of homelessness faster than anybody else, too. So you've got the guy who's there who can jump in the dumpster without it making his skin crawl because he was trained to handle adversity. And he's not there anymore to grab the bag of bagels out from behind Giant. You know, so we take these people, these leaders, out of the homeless population pretty quickly, too. Anyway, so Invisible is a comic book. The superhero, Mac, he's a Native American. I did a lot of research for this book. It was actually, the concepts were written by my brother, Phil, who at 55 is still reading comic books. he's a brilliant comic book writer. And so the concepts were his, but the background research I did, and I found out that the highest percentage of the population that has ever enlisted is Native Americans. So our homeless superhero is a Native American man, and his name is Mac, and he can turn invisible. And it's all explained in the book, but he picked up the talent and the ability to go invisible when he was in Vietnam. So this every time he uses his invisibility, it kind of freezes him in time, so he's not really as old as you would expect him to be, or he doesn't look that old, because his invisibility keeps him younger.
Huh. And you, the Charles Bruce Foundation and the United States Army Heritage Education Center, you guys have partnered on this, if I understand right?
Yeah, I could not believe it. I walked in there because I wanted a military place to do the launch from. And so I just walked in there and asked if I could talk to somebody about hosting the book launch there, which is on Veterans Day. And they were really enthusiastic. They said, let us get you all the paperwork. We can set you up with and so we have a little auditorium there. We're going to show my friend Max Donnelly is making a slideshow out of the comic book. So you can come in and, you know, obviously we'll have comic books there, but you could just come in and watch the comic book unfold before you. You can meet the artists. You can meet my brother Phil. I'll be there. And, you know, we want to talk to you about homelessness, veterans. All the proceeds benefit people. We don't take any money for it. So we're going to help veterans and another group. I can't tell you who they are because it's a spoiler alert for the end of the book.
Oh, outstanding. And how do I get some of them? Who do I buy them from? Because I want to give them out to listeners. I want to be able to hand some of them out.
Oh, awesome. Well, we have a bunch of deals, but you could just go to the invisiblevet.com. I couldn't even believe that was available. Invisiblevet.com, all the ways to get the book are there. And one of the things we're really plugging is you can get 20 books and name a VA clinic or a homeless shelter, and we'll make sure they get them. So if you want to buy 20 books, and don't do Lebanon because we already have a whole pile of them going there. But if you want to, you say, just get me a VA clinic in New Mexico. We'll send 20 copies to the VA clinic in New Mexico. And so that's something we're really hoping that people do, just to get these books into the hands of veterans and maybe even veterans who are having a really bad day that day.
Yeah, because, you know, I've been saying, you know, since the right-wing spin machine has been spending all of their time attacking President Biden and attacking this country over leaving Afghanistan, which we should have done years ago, in my view.
Yeah.
I say now our focus has to come back home and take care of the people who for 20 years were fighting this war. For
right.
20 years, in my view,
deployment.
Have been neglected
right.
and basically invisible. So now's the time where we make them visible and we actually help.
Yeah. Smedley Butler, right? War's a racket.
Yep.
And it is a racket. And $300 million a day we spent on that war. I wrote a column for Commentary in the online magazine about 5 years ago that we could have taken every, if we were really worried about Afghan girls, we could have taken every Afghan girl out of Afghanistan and put them in a U.S. college for less than the war cost.
Yeah. I mean, had we taken
every single one of them.
Had we taken those trillions of dollars and spent them here, we would have no homelessness, we would have no hunger, we would have none of those problems.
Right, and I am thrilled. I even give a little credit to his predecessor because, you know, even a broken clock's right twice a day, because we got an opportunity for, he started the ball, like it was a boulder, he just kicked off of a cliff the way he did it. But at least it got rolling. And, you know, Biden's turning out to be a better president than I ever expected to be because I'm a flame and screaming liberal, right? And he's been pretty conservative, plenty. And I really think that he's done what a ship of state to be trying to steer.
Yeah.
What a mess right now. And constantly with those barking, yipping, you know, bad guys just chomping at his heels all the time. And I'm just really impressed.
Yeah, he happened to look at his watch, so that means he hates the troops and all that. As were the former guy didn't even bother showing up.
Well, you know what? The other thing I'm thankful to him for, I saw a coffin. We had this disinformation. There was no draft. Nobody really tasted any pain except the poor people who, out of poverty, enlisted in the military. And those people were redeployed and redeployed and redeployed and redeployed. And people can argue with me about it all they want, but I'm the one who got them in my homeless shelters. So I'm going to have some ammunition.
Yeah.
And then when they are totally worn down, when we teach them the only way to fix this problem is to break it, and then they come home the type of people who learn to break things, and we're angry at them. And as Biden said in his speech the other day, they're killing themselves 15 or 18 a day. We have so much work to do for our veterans. We have so much we need to invest in them, care about them, love on them, gratitude we need to give them. That war didn't, I was never in favor of any of these wars. But the people who went there went with love of country and a desire to protect and serve their country. And we treated them poorly.
No, I said at the very beginning, you know, I say this all the time. I came of age politically and mentally in the mid 70s, right at the time where the Vietnam War was ending and they were just dumping poor people with broken bodies, broken minds, horrible drug and alcohol problems back into our housing project. And they were just dumped there like garbage. In fact, you know, I'll still never forget the guy in the heavy green army coat who we found dead on the side of the neighbor's house with a needle in his arm because there was nobody there to help him.
Yeah, it's terrible. And now that's not true of the VA. Now, I mean, Secretary Shinseki under the Obama administration, he promised veterans he'd fix things. And I wish I had his address. I would mail him an invitation to our launch, or at least mail him a comic book. Because there are still things that need to be changed. The definition of homelessness needs to be changed for these veterans. If you're a female veteran and you come home from war and some guy says, you know, if you do my dishes and clean my house, I'll let you live in my house. And she does that, which, by the way, is not going to end well. She's not considered homeless, even though the only way she can have a roof over her head is basically to become somebody else's, oh, God knows what. That person is not considered homeless, so she can't be getting the kind of help that she deserves.
Yeah.
Well, so we need things to change, but still, even with the base definition and other problems, the VA does the best job of any organization, better than FEMA, better than Department of Housing and Urban Development, although Secretary Fudge, another great job Biden did putting her in work. You know, there are people now with a focus, and I hope they manage to do for other people what Shinseki did for the veterans.
No, and we're going to need it because, you know, as you mentioned a second ago, with this moratorium being lifted and the evictions, the tsunami of evictions that are coming, what are we going to do with people?
Right. Well, we're going to look away from their suffering because that's what we're good at. And they're going to be invisible. And I'm going to have to keep writing stupid books.
I don't see this as stupid at all. I see this as... comic books were never my thing, but I am going to definitely get one, and I'm going to get a bunch of them, and we're gonna give them out because this is a good thing. In fact, I'm going to reach out to my union folks and say, hey, you should be buying some of these to help out as well. Give them out to the membership. Give them out to people. As the more we spread the word, the more the message gets out, maybe the more we can actually change things.
Right. Thank you, Rick. And, you know, I appreciate you giving me time tonight to talk about it because – it is. I mean, I think there's always a new way to skin a cat, and I'm always trying to find that new way to skin a cat and trying to find that one way to say to somebody, yeah, you can care about this and you can make a difference. And I got to tell you, the biggest difference you can make is voting. And people don't believe that they're that important. If your vote didn't matter, a whole pile of bad guys wouldn't be trying to steal it from you right now.
Yeah, I mean, Texas wouldn't be doing what they were doing. Texas is ground zero for horrible right now with the voting thing that they pulled off, and now this abortion ban.
Your voting and your uterus are mine.
I gotta be honest. There's nothing funny about that for me.
No, I'm not one of those unfortunate people like the doctor on The Simpsons who laughs at inappropriate moments. I mean, I just feel like I'm. It's just unbelievable that they. You know, I'm 60 years old. It's 2021. Are we still really telling women that they don't know what's good for themselves?
Yes. And look, I've said, and you can disagree with me, I've said this isn't the end. I mean, they want to go after Griswold and undo birth control because we want women barefoot pregnant back in the kitchen making pie.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with pie.
Yeah, I love pie.
I just got to say that. But no, people should have a right to make their own choices. And they say that loud and clear when it comes to a mask. But they don't even respect it. This is about control and, you know, I'm just preaching to the choir. You know, this is just unbelievable. And yet people who they really can help, you want to help somebody? Give me a call. I can give you long lists of names of people who could take 20 minutes of your assistance.
Yeah.
You know,
we've got plenty of things to do. So last line of questioning I've got, because I want people to go to invisiblevet.com. That's the website, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Pick up the comic book, pick up 20 of them, pick up 100 of them if you can. Is there more than one? I'm looking at the art that you have available for like 20 bucks. Is there more than one comic book? Will there be a series?
Well, I don't know. At this point, where it's pretty self-contained. It's got the backstory, the plot. You know, there's always a traumatic thing that turns you into a superhero, Batman and his parents getting murdered, blah, blah, blah. So the all that plot, pre-plot stuff is there, and then there's a really great caper that happens that Max solves. But what I have learned from doing comic books, which I didn't ever know before, is that if you're a collector, you like the variant cover. So there's the main cover, the one where he's sleeping by the dumpster. But then there's a variant cover, which is him walking in the rain, and this kid can see him even though he's invisible. So that's the variant cover, and that'll be a limited edition. 50 covers will be made that way. And people, that was on our Kickstarter, and people can, you know, purchase that variant cover, which collectors go nuts for.
There you go. No, this is good stuff. Again, the website, invisiblevet.com. We'll get links out on social media. Hopefully folks will go and buy them up, and you'll have to do a second run and maybe a third run to make this first run the collector's item. So go get them early, get them off and hand them out. Christmas is not too far down the road. All good stuff. Now the event is what, November 1st?
No, November 11th.
November 11th. I got one of the ones.
It's at the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center, but we also we'll also, if you want to have a local event, we'll try and hook up with you wherever you are. So if you, maybe one of the artists or one of the writers can come to where you are, or we can just send books to your local bookstore, a local comic shop.
There you go.
So, you know, by all means, reach out to us, invisiblevet.com, and we'll do anything we can to make sure that you can celebrate your veteran locally.
Good stuff. Pat, I appreciate the time. Great talking with you.
Yeah, thank you, Rick. Thank you.
Invisiblevet.com, the website. Make sure you check that out. My good friend Pat LaMarche. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1885. White miners in Rock Spring, Wyoming, planned to wipe out the entire town's Chinese community. Chinese immigrants came to the United States looking for work, first in the California gold mines, then as laborers on the Transcontinental Railroad. Later, some worked for the Union Pacific-owned coal mines, including the one in Rock Springs. Union Pacific used racial animosity to divide its labor force. The company quashed the union at Rock Springs and only rehired 50 white miners. The other 150 miners were Chinese. And on this morning, two white miners went to the mines and beat two Chinese miners, one to death. A mob of 150 whites armed with rifles marched into Chinatown. The mob gave Chinese residents an hour to pack up and leave. However, after 30 minutes, some started shooting off their rifles. One Chinese miner was killed. The Chinese workers panicked and tried to flee. White rioters robbed, beat, and even killed the Chinese workers that they could catch. In a report to the New York Chinese consulate, Chinese survivors related some of the rioters would let a Chinese go after depriving him of all his gold and silver, while another would be beaten with the butt ends of the weapon before being let go. Some of the rioters would shoot a Chinese dead on the spot. Some stood by, shouting loudly and laughing and clapping their hands. That night, white rioters burned down every building in Chinatown. In all, 28 Chinese workers were killed. President Grover Cleveland sent in federal troops to quell the violence. In the aftermath, the Chinese workers did not want to return to work. Union Pacific did not want to lose its cheap labor force and forced their return to the mines.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.